Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Poet Runner. Today we have Rich Ferguson and Richard Modiano. We'll begin the show now.
Well, welcome, Rich Ferguson. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Well, Richard, I'm honored. Thank you.
Oh, well, the honor is mine. And listeners, we're going to be talking about Rich's background as a poet, and also we're going to be devoting some time to the anthology Beat Not Beat, recently published by Moontide Press, where Rich is the lead editor on that. And they fit in seamlessly together, as I hope our conversation will make clear. So, Rich, I wanted to start by asking, what was your initial connection to poetry? Of all of the arts out there, why did that one draw you to it?
Yes. Of all the arts you can choose from, that's a good question. I had always been interested in writing as a child, reading, and in college, my last semester at Rutgers, I was taking a fiction class, but the last week, you know, the teacher sort of, you know, did these sort of obligatory, okay, we're going to spend the last week of the semester writing poetry, and I just loved that part of the class, and she said to me after the class had ended, she said, you're a better poet than you are a fiction writer, and you know, I could not, you know, argue with her on that point. Poetry definitely came more naturally to me. After Rutgers, I pretty much made a beeline for California, packed up my drums, came out, briefly landed in L.A., but then went straight to San Francisco. And my first stop there was City Lights, picked up a copy of Corso's Gasoline, and I was hooked. I was like, this is where I'm supposed to be. These are my people. And, you know, started going to readings, growing up in public, just putting myself out there, you know, learning from my mistakes, learning from the wisdom of other poets who had been doing it a lot longer than me, and just, you know, kept growing, kept learning. When I saw Ann Waldman, she came through San Francisco when I was living there, and I was just completely blown away. I mean, she wasn't reading from paper. She had all her work not only memorized, but it was like she embodied the work. And she just, you know, prowled the stage. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to shoot for that. And so I began memorizing my work and kind of trying to approach poetry more that way, in a performative way. And also I was playing, you know, drums in a band and stuff, so I was kind of performing that way too, but also the rhythm of playing drums also kind of helped to inform my writing, the way I performed it, and also the way I edited my writing, because I would kind, and it's gotten better over time, but I would kind of listen for the words and phrases that sang, that really hit a note, like, yeah, this is flowing, this sounds good. And times where things clunked, I was like, ooh, that sounds off. I need to just kind of tailor that a little bit to let it sing a little bit more. But yeah, those are kind of my beginnings. I eventually made my way back to LA in the early 90s and have been here ever since, and have been very grateful to know people like you and S.A. Griffin, Alexis Roan Fancher, and such amazing poets throughout Los Angeles, throughout California.
Well, I can see the connection to Ann Waldman in your work. As I've noted before in talking to other poets, one of the challenges in writing free verse is to keep the music in it. Because when we talk about the classical forms in English poetry, if you wanted to write poetry, you had to be aware of the measure. You had to be aware of how many beats you wanted the line to have. and how that would affect the subsequent line. And it was, you had to basically do a lot of calculation before you wrote your poem. With free verse, that took that away, because the sort of the initial advantage of free verse was that you did not have to calculate. You could write in the heat of emotion. You could be spontaneous in your written gesture, but you would lose the music often. And putting the music back in free verse is a real challenge, and that is something that you have mastered. And I think mentioning your background as a musician, as a drummer, of course, the drummer is the guy that keeps the beat going in an yeah. ensemble. And that organically, I mean, it's not in listening to your work, and I've heard you read live many times, it comes out organically, in other words, seamlessly. It doesn't come out in an artificial way at all. And it also, and I know there, as any poet knows, there's a lot of work behind any given poem. And when a listener hears it for the first time, it seems effortless, but we know that there's a lot of effort that goes into making the poem. But that it seems effortless, that is the effect that we want to end up with. Unless, of course, the subject of your poem is the struggle to write a poem. But otherwise, we want that... you know, you want that sort of effortless sound in the poem, and at the same time, your poems are also very rich in imagery, and it's very striking, and it is physical. That's another thing that really impresses me about your work. So there is this solid physicality to it, and at the same time, there's energy involved as well. So it's not like a piece of granite sitting there. It's more like a disc flying through the air, or hurling a stone across the sky, and you keep your eye on that, and you can see it going like a comet. It's more like a comet. It's blazing in a way, that's really exciting. That's the reason, listeners, that you want to go to poetry readings, because you want to hear the poet pour himself or herself out in front of you with all of that energy, and sometimes, you know, you can still get it on reading it on the page, but once you've heard a poet read their own work and you go back to reading their work again, then it's a new experience. And I think that with Rich's poems, there are some that I read before I heard him read them, and then there are some that I heard him recite before I read them myself. And I found that they work together marvelously. I mean, you can see what he was after. I mean, I myself look at poetry very carefully. I do close readings of it not because it's like an assignment or anything, but because it's something of interest to me. And, you know, I take pleasure from it. And I take pleasure from poetry like Rich's because it's poetry that is alive and breathing even on the page. And that is something that I really like about your work and about that school of poetry that you have mined so successfully.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think one of the highest compliments, kind of touching back on something you said, one of the highest compliments people have paid me from time to time is after I've performed, they come up to me and have said, "Were you just making that all up off the top of your head?" No. A lot of work really went into that, but I'm glad that it came out so seamlessly that you felt that way. But no, a lot of work went into it, a lot of writing, a lot of taking long walks and reciting the poems to myself or sitting in my car in traffic. So, but it's kind of that whole idea again about, you know, when I saw Anne Waldman, how she embodied the poem. And I also... And I did this a lot. I mean, I was doing it before COVID, but definitely during COVID, I was more mindful of trying to remember my poems because I wasn't able to go out and perform live. So I was doing some memory courses and stuff and learning more about embodying my poems and placing certain lines, certain gestures into certain parts of my body or using physicality, certain gestures to spark certain lines of poems. So that has definitely helped me to do that thing that you're talking about a bit more about embodying the work and being more energetic with the work.
So what, to give our listeners, to let our listeners know what we are talking about, could you lay a poem on us right now, Rich?
Sure, yeah. And this is one from Everything is Radiant Between the Hates. And this is one, I wanted to read this for a couple reasons. One, I know you are an appreciator of film noir, and also, you know, L.A. has been a city that I love Los Angeles now, and I have for some years now. But when I first came here, there was definitely a sort of a love-hate relationship I had with the city, and it definitely took me some time to get used to the city. But I think some of the poems that I've written that I enjoy the most are ones that I've written related to Los Angeles. So this one's called Soundtrack to a Modern Day LA Palm Noir. Sounds of Hollywood land, thrills and chills set in ultra moody hues of 1940s and 50s gangster LA. Brass-knuckled fast talk of hard-boiled thugs and detectives, kiss-me-deadly melodies of femme fatales, bar brawls, catcalls. The cold click of stiletto heels, stiletto blades, and more cooler doors closing on still another John Doe. Those sounds mixed with present-day sounds, riotous rhythms forged from hands of Leimert Park djembe demigods break-beating on wings of rap and revolution car horns, car radios, car alarms. Freeways clogged with huddled and befuddled masses inching towards invention, reinvention, prosperity, invisibility, the bark and bite of bulldogs and bulldog revolvers. Our past and present city sounds combining and recombining to create the soundtrack to a modern-day L.A. Palm Noir. A white heat, double indemnity song of live and die set deep in the blood pulsing through the hearts and minds of one and all. Century City lawyers to San Pedro dock workers, West Side yoga warriors to Skid Row worriers, drug addicts to the clean and sober, clergy members to tattooed rock dogs, those on their deathbeds and those suffering from fevered dreams of almighty stardom, our soundtrack to a modern-day L.A. Palm Noir. Packs the hot and howling will of Santa Ana winds, earworms its way into our souls, jukeboxes with our inner demon, seeks alleyways as if they're confessionals in which to share sins, its mirrors and reflections, rain and complex plot lines. Fingernails dragging across our blackboard jungle brains as that voice in our head proclaims, yeah, I've been beaten up, but I'm not beaten, and I'm not quitting. Our soundtrack to a modern-day L.A. Palm Noir, stained with a history of notorious crimes and criminals, from the Black Dahlia to Sharon Tate, the Hillside Strangler, to the Grim Sleeper. It's a hymn filled with hums of late-night neon signs and the short vowel sound of death's last sigh on a victim's lips. Ohms and bad omens, sirens and babies crying, police helicopters circling, buzzing like hornets out for a sudden sting. One must develop an ear for our city song, harmonize slow and steady at first, think cruise into the fast lane, dodge multi-car pileups of those who burned out before burning bright, anxious leaps of faith that only a precious few have survived our soundtrack to a modern-day L.A. Palm Noir. A lurid and lethal hunger fueled by gasoline, sweat, and tears, decked out in false eyelashes and false promises. It's a true love and true crime booty call, wooing with stroked and stoked hallelujahs, purring like sex kittens, knitting kisses out of thin air, moving, grooving, coaxing, cajoling. Ready to find us innocent or guilty beneath midnight street lights shining like halos and interrogation lights, our soundtrack to a modern-day L.A. Palm Noir. It's a death song in the key of cordite heard by Sam Cooke when taking a bullet at the Hacienda Hotel. It's a nonstop party song wheeled by Tom Waits, Ziggy Pop, and Janis Joplin at the Tropicana in the low-rent, high-spirited late 60s. Yeah, songbirds sit on phone lines mimicking our city's Rev and Dread soundtrack. Earthquakes only visit us because they want to learn how to shake, rattle, and roll like we do. From Olivera Street to Rodeo Drive, from Watchtower to the Miracle Mile, generations of races and ethnicities, occupations and preoccupations adding to our city's song. From labor movements battling 1920s union busters to 50s and 60s Chavez-Ravine families facing down bulldozers and eviction notices, from African Americans chased out of 1930s sundown towns to the later cries of Rodney King when suffering the blows and bruises of racism-wielding police. From the technicolor visions of Timothy Leary to the technicolor machinations of Raymond Chandler, yeah, our city song, it can be so serious and surreal. Drum loops of dull footsteps pacing confines of 6x8 cells at Men's Central Jail mixed with the disembodied voice of Joe Gillis narrating the story of Sunset Boulevard while floating dead in the swimming pool. Other days, our city song is a raucous hip-hop crumping and locking down Hollywood Boulevard, a funky freestyle red carpet gala popping with paparazzi and Klieg-like bonfires illuminating our highest selves. Yeah, let us shine, let us shine, let us shine. Our glorified and gangstified city sounds, revving their engines, burning rubber on asphalt, breaking all natural and supernatural speed limits, drag racing down the 10 freeway to 5, 405, 101, and 60 for all points north, south, east, and west, from Koreatown to Croatian Place, Little Moscow, Little Ethiopia, Lake Balboa to Larchmont, Echo Park to the Palisades, yeah, every shade in L.A.'s urban crayon box, creating the mood, mystery, shadows, and light, harboring the living and dead, everything existing between celluloid and the flesh, all the devils and angels that are our dance partners in this manic and mystical, sadistic and symphonic soundtrack to our modern-day L.A. Palm Noir.
Listeners, this is you've gotten basically in this poem. You have a tapestry that weaves in L.A. history, recent 20th and 21st century L.A. history, pop culture, pulp fiction, all woven in together, and it is really totally L.A. It's Los Angeles compressed into a single poem, and I think that if anybody creates an anthology of Los Angeles fiction and nonfiction, I've often dreamed of such an anthology that would combine historical snippets along the lines of Mike Davis's penetrating analysis, like in The Ecology of Fear, with fiction and with poetry. And I would pick your poem to be the introduction to all of that because it has all of that packed into it.
Wow.
I think.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, speaking of Los Angeles,
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to just ask you, because speaking of Los Angeles, you know, one of the first times I met you, you know, was with your involvement with Beyond Baroque and, you know, being the director and everything. And I'm curious about I think some of the joys are obvious, but I'm wondering what some of the greatest challenges you face with keeping poetry and Beyond Baroque alive and thriving in a city like Los Angeles, which is so vast and, you know, yeah.
Well, a complicated answer that I would have to give, but I'll try and be brief, was that when I became director of Beyond Baroque, its curatorial direction was quite narrow. The previous administration was not welcoming to the untried. And there were a lot of barriers. And what I wanted to do was take those barriers down and open the space to people who were just starting out. And basically, I had an egalitarian vision for Beyond Baroque, so that the programming would be the high, the middle, and the low, the new and the old, the established and the tyros. And I thought that would be a way of bringing all of the different poetic voices in Los Angeles together. And we did reach out to other poetry centers, the World Stage in Lamart Park, Tia Chucha's Cafe Cultural in the San Fernando Valley, and people from out of state, people from other countries, even from Asia. So that is what I tried to do. And you know, Los Angeles is on the Pacific Rim, and it's sort of a key city on the Pacific Rim. And the Pacific Rim stretches from Tierra del Fuego at the tip of South America all the way up to Alaska and around to Siberia, Japan, the coast of China, the Philippines, the Pacific. And that was how I saw poetry at that time. I mean, we have the East Coast. The East Coast faces the old world, and the East Coast draws from Europe, and that is where that's, you know, basically what the sensibility of the East Coast is basically, to me, European. Although it has a lot of people, for example, in New York City, where I lived for many years, there was a large Haitian population, Puerto Rican population, Dominican population, Filipino population. But here on the West Coast, we are, our culture is sort of a dialectical conversation between South America, Central America, the indigenous peoples of the West Coast, the Asian nations of Japan, China, the Philippines, and that is what I think sets it apart.
Yeah,
and that is something that I tried to bring into the mix. For example, when the Pacific Coast Poetry Series was being created, I gave it that name. I called it the Pacific Coast Poetry Series, which was a sub-imprint of Beyond Baroque Books. And as I explained at the time to Henry Morrow, Suzanne Lemus, and Liz Camfiore, who were the other co-founders, I said, we are on the Pacific Coast, and we should take advantage of that and set ourselves apart from the East Coast, which pretty much has the old world of Europe nailed down. We have this whole frontier of South America and Asia at our disposal, The entire coast of the United States and Canada. So that's where we should be. That's what we should be looking at. Those are the poets that we should be promoting, publishing, and exposing to the world, so to speak. So that was the idea that I had in mind.
Yeah. Well, well done. I honor your time there, and I honor you as a poet. And listeners, I also want to share another example of Richard's huge heart. We were, and we're going to talk about this in a little while, but the Beat Not Beat anthology that Richard mentioned earlier, we were doing a reading up at Burden Beckett in San Francisco a couple weeks ago. And at the end of the reading, Richard offered to everyone there if they didn't have enough money to buy a book, that he would buy it for them. I just, Richard, thank you. That will always stay with me. And it just goes to show not only your generosity, but, you know, the generosity of so many in the poetry community. And the, you know, that I graduated college with a degree in advertising and public relations. I'm so glad I packed up my car, didn't go to New York to get an ad job, and came out to California to do music and play poetry, because it's given, you know, me the honor to know people like you, to work alongside people like you. So thank you.
Well, The pleasure is mine, Rich. I mean, it's let's talk about Beat Not Beat. In fact, can you lay? You're the lead editor, but you're also a contributor to that anthology. So,
yes.
Rich has a poem in there. When called in for questioning, can you lay that one on us?
Sure. When asked about the scars around your lips, tell them you were speaking peace in a shattered glass world. When asked about employment, say you were a wound collector on the broken frontier. As for where you reside, tell them your heart is equidistant between joy and suffering, the now and never, the sweet flower and Hiroshima cloud. Regarding why you say the things you say, tell them the full moon is in your mouth. When asked about the ghosts behind your eyes, tell them you spend too much time thinking about who you are to become rather than whom you are supposed to be. As for why some leave the world too soon, tell them death's reflexes are sometimes quicker than prayer.
And that's a beautiful poem. And all of the poems in this anthology there are many voices, and they share, there's sort of a common underlying sensibility, and at the same time, all of the voices are unique and different. How did this anthology come together, Rich?
Good question. Well, I guess you could say during lockdown, I was challenged as far as how I could create some of my spoken word music videos that prior to COVID I was, freely collaborating with musicians and, directors and everything. During COVID, I was very limited, doing a lot of stuff myself, collaborating with Butch Norton, who's Lucinda Williams' drummer. We would send files back and forth. But at the end of a lot of those videos, I was putting, copyright 2020 or, 2021, Beat Not Beat. And Kathleen Florence, a Canadian poet, visual artist, reached out to me, and she was like, oh, Beat Not Beat, that's a really cool phrase. You should do something with that. So I was ruminating on it, and, I had spent a number of years being a poetry editor for the online literary journal, The Nervous Breakdown, and when I stopped doing that, I thought, and then in 2020, right smack when COVID and quarantine hit hard, Everything is Radiant Between the Hates came out, and I was awarded this title of Beat Poet Laureate of California by the National Beat Poetry Foundation back east. And I was like, I can't do any touring. I can't, I'm very limited as far as how I can promote other poets. I can only, do Zoom things or whatever. And then, I was thinking about the whole Beat Not Beat thing, and I was like, I want to create an anthology of California poets. And so I first reached out to Eric Morago at Moontide Press, and who had released Everything is Radiant, and he was like, I love the idea. Let's go with it. And right away I knew that, I would need a really good team. I knew it was something that if I wanted to, I had a grander an idea than what I could just do myself. So I reached out to, I initially reached out to Alexis Roan Fancher, an LA poet, and Kim Shuck, former San Francisco poet laureate. And Alexis started helping to get some LA poets that I wasn't aware of. Kim Shuck helped to get some Bay Area poets that I wasn't aware of that I hadn't yet already reached out to. And then I reached out to S.A. Griffin, L.A.'s finest and one of L.A.'s finest. And S.A. really took it, kind of to another level. He was able to gain access to, the estates of, the Cassidys and reach out to Michael C. Ford and get a poem by Jim Morrison and, Diane DePrima. And so and Ferlinghetti and Richard, you too. I mean, you know, I was corresponding with you very, you were definitely a touchstone very early on in the process, where I was like, yeah, I have this idea for an anthology, Beat Not Beat. You have any ideas of people who I could put into the book? So you were, you know, I think you were one of the people who had reminded me of Philip LaMantia, who was a poet that I had read quite a bit when I was living in San Francisco. But you also helped to turn me on to, you know, Lou Welch and just all these other poets. Like, wow, I wasn't aware of that poet. So it's really been a learning experience, a growing experience, and it's one of those situations where, you know, if you bring in a really good team of collaborators, you can really, I mean, the book has exceeded my wildest dreams. I had grand ideas for it, but with SA and Alexis and Kim and people like you, Richard, and Kathleen Florence offering continual support and now creating the Beat Not Beat website and the blog and everything, it's really exceeded my wildest dreams. So thank you to all, to you, Richard, and to all those I mentioned.
Well, listeners, we talked about community, and this is really an example of the poetry community coming together. Rich, he as the lead editor. I mean, it's really tremendous that you reached out to these other people, because they're often, you know, we talk about, I am the guy that is editing this book. Nobody else. I don't want to hear from you. I don't want any other input. I have my own particular vision, and I'm going to realize, and I don't want anybody polluting it with their own ideas. That's not how it works in community. You know, we have each other's backs in community, and certainly you were the catalyst for this, and you were the coordinator, supervisor of it all, and you are certainly to be commended for your acumen in putting this thing together and assembling the cast of characters, because it was it's a Herculean task to get all of these different voices between two covers. So, listeners, this is a really terrific anthology. And Rich mentioned there's the website. What is the website officially called?
BeatNotBeat.com.
Okay, and the blog?
Actually, listeners, Richard Modiano actually has a recent post on the Beat Not Beat blog. There's a link on the Beat Not Beat website for the blog and Richard's post, which Richard, actually, this was something else I wanted to ask you, because you really raised some interesting points in what you were, you know, the whole idea of first thought, best thought, and all of that. And it harkened back to my time being in a band, also with my time of writing certain poems. But an example of being in a band, we'd come up with a song idea, and there was that initial spark and fire that it was like, this is really cool. We're really onto something here. And then we would just work it and rework it and literally just beat it into the ground to where it just, you couldn't even recognize it, from its former self. It's just two completely unrelated entities. And we kind of all were left looking at one another like, how did that happen? How did we allow that to happen? And with certain poems, too, I've written, you know, you get this initial spark and you're like, well, I have to go dig back into it and stuff and just edit it and re-edit it and things like that. And it's just like, this stinks, like, ugh, next or whatever. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about that post you wrote and how you go about that. I think Corso referred to it as tailoring, how you do that for your own work.
Well, one of the things that inspired that post is there was a misunderstanding of first thought, best thought, which for listeners not familiar with the history of beat prosody, the idea was, well, there's a long history going back to Charles Olson in 1950 writing his essay Projective Verse, which is where he discussed closed form versus open form, what we were talking about earlier as free verse. And the aesthetic idea that he put out there combined with earlier objectivist ideas of poetry, in other words, William Carlos Williams' famous statement was no ideas but in things. In other words, do not start with an abstraction. If you want to talk about joy, what is the thing that makes you joyful? Don't say, I feel happy. Why are you feeling happy? What made you happy? Describe that. Start with that, because then you have something that is solid. So building from that, then Olson's Projective Verse, and then later on Kerouac talked about spontaneous bop prosody. And then finally by the 1970s, Allen Ginsberg heard a lecture by his Buddhist teacher at the time, Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, where Trungpa said, first thought, best thought, and explained what that meant. So that sort of like summed up this whole history starting from approximately the 20s with the objectivist going through and being sort of added to by the Beats, Kerouac, Ginsberg, Corso. Diane de Prima also had her own prosody that she was, when she in her memoir, My Life as a Woman, she talks about her discussions with Kerouac and how that opened up her own particular poetic practice. Anyway, this all sort of came together by the 1970s and was condensed into first thought, best thought, which later on was misunderstood as first word, best word. In fact, I've even seen some essays where, unlike Ginsberg, first word, best word, he said first word, best word, but that always doesn't work out that way. But that's not what he said. He didn't say first word, best word. He said first thought, best thought. And when he said and thought, from his perspective as a Buddhist, thought also includes emotions, it includes images, it includes whatever your brain produces. For example, you know, you work with music, Rich, so you hear a tune. That tune that you hear in your head is a thought, but it's not words. It's music.
Right.
So that is the whole thing behind that, and also images. So music, images, ideas, these are the things that combine to make a poem. I mean, Ezra Pound used three Greek words, and I don't remember them all now, but he talked about melopoeia, which is the music, panopoeia, which is the images, and then the ideas. And the ideas are embodied in the images, and the images are brought to life by the music. So all of those three things coming together, that is the idea of what makes a good poem. If you can bring all of those things working together in harmony, then you've got it going. In fact, when I was a kid, I went to a poetry reading. I heard Charles Bukowski read. And I actually went up to him afterward, and I said, Mr. Bukowski, what do you need to be a good what do you need to know to be a good poet? And he said, kid, you need to know how to drive all the horses at once. And I didn't know what he was talking. I didn't know what he was talking about then, but I think what he was talking about was putting together the music, the ideas, and the images, driving those horses all at once.
Yep.
So
yeah, go ahead.
No, after you.
I was just going to quickly say, speaking of Bukowski, I recently heard Suzanne Lummis, who's, and you mentioned her earlier, I recently heard her say that the Bukowski poem that we have in the in Beat Not Beat, Tragedy of the Leaves, is one of her favorite Bukowski poems. And she had mentioned that it was one of his earlier poems, but in her opinion was one of his finest poems. And it really made me feel good to hear her say that, because that was the Bukowski poem that had always, I mean, I love his work, but that was one of the ones that had so deeply resonated with me. And it kind of just exemplified one of the things, you know, is going for with this anthology, another example of, you know, making connections, how, you know, certain poems speak to all of us over time, connect us not only, you know, to the author who wrote it, but to one another, you know, who reads those words and appreciates those words. So, yeah. Anyway, I was keep going with your first
well,
thought. Beth.
We are just about out of time. But listeners, if you want to, if you cannot see Rich perform in person, you can go to his website, where he has some music videos posted. You can see him performing. They're not all raw performances. There's some of them, they're actually very fine short films with his words and with music. So, Rich, what your website is?
Oh, rich-ferguson.com.
Okay, that's easy to find. So, listeners, I do recommend you check that out. Rich has two collections of poetry and a novel. It's all on the website. Here, the recent collection was published by Moontide Press. The first one, Eighth in Agony, was published by Punk Hostage Press.
Yeah.
And the novel is published by Rare Bird, if I recall correctly.
Yep.
And if you are going to buy these books, buy them directly from the publishers, because it is small presses are the ones that are taking the risks in poetry, and they are the ones that need your support more than anything. So, and you can buy them from their websites. You can buy them directly from them. In the rare case that you can't do it for some reason, look for it at your local bookstore. Ask them to order it. And as a last resort, if all else fails, then go to Amazon. But do get these books, and especially get Beat Not Beat. There are going to be future readings coming up. There have already been a few.
Yep.
There will be more, Rich tells me, next year, I think, is the next one coming up. Is that correct, in January? News about those will be at the Beat Not Beat website. So, Rich, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and we will meet again.
Thank you, Richard. It's been an honor and pleasure. Take care.
You too.
Hello, Bart?
Yeah.
Hello?
I can hear you now.
Yeah, we had a technical glitch. I'm sorry about that. How are you, Ann? What do you run? Do you run 5Ks, half marathons, marathons, ultra marathons? What is your run?
I run the whole gamut of things. I just completed an ultra 50-mile ultra marathon Saturday.
Wow. Where was that?
It's the Brazos Bend marathon. It's kind of just south of Houston in Texas.
The most I ran is a 50K, and that was a lot for me. I'm trying to build myself up to a 50 miler. What's the difference between training for a 50 miler and say a 50K?
For me it was kind of hard because you know, being a parent to two middle schoolers and, you know, a husband, training was kind of difficult, but you it's kind of like building a marathon plane, but you're just tacking on just a few extra miles, you know, for each run, you know, over the few extra weeks that you actually as well.
Yeah, I've interviewed people who've done 100 milers, and it's a different mindset. I mean, it's a lot. I think there's more focus that you have to maintain.
Right. It's a race, but it's not the race. It's not a race like you think it should be, where you got to, you know, you're competing against yourself totally. That's not about other people at this point. At least it's not. That's the way I see it. I mean, I attempted this 50-miler back in April, but at a different course. I wasn't even prepared for the course. The course was just astronomically, the elevation gain was way out of my league. The race director said it was like running a 75-mile ultramarathon, and I actually didn't finish it. I got to 45.6 miles, and I just couldn't go any further. It takes a different mindset to actually be in these things and know what you're going to have to accomplish in order to get through them.
Yeah, it's when I train, I don't train for speed. I just train to maintain endurance. So I've been running up, running and climbing right now just to, get myself ready for the... Because my ultra got canceled. It was supposed to be on December 3rd, but because of rain, the men people couldn't get there or whatever they said. So I got, one more month to train. So I got a month more to train for it to get my head, ready for it again.
Cool. So what's the elevation gain for what you're going for?
I'm not sure about the elevation. I mean, I did the Bulldog, and that elevation was pretty high.
Oh, okay.
But, I think it's about the same elevation. I'm kind of silly. I don't think about the elevation. I just run, even though I know the elevation is going to hit me when I get there.
Right.
Because it did hit me during the Bulldog. I mean, it hit me hard when I was doing the Bulldog. The second loop kind of wiped me out, but I still finished. It took me about 8 hours and 20 minutes to finish a 31-mile run.
Okay, that's not bad.
Yeah, at the same time, you beat yourself up because you want to get it done in 6 hours. You're not being realistic with yourself, and you're like, I can do this in 6 hours, but nope, couldn't do it.
Totally understand that one.
I admire somebody who can do 50 miles because, I want to get to 50 miles. I want to get to the point where it's like, I know it's going to be a struggle, but it's like, I don't know, I just enjoy the running, seeing how far I can take myself. Is that the same for you?
Right. Yeah, and that was a lot of it. I enjoy the running. The training, though, to train for it is really, it gets to you, especially when you're a busy parent. It's hard. There are a lot of late nights where I'm up running and after the, family's gone to bed or something like that. Just try to squeeze in a run as quickly as I can so I can be with them.
Well, it's kind of, it's the same thing. We had a poet on earlier. There was this one poet that he would do all his writing from 4 to, 6 or 7. Then when the family came, he wouldn't do any writing. He would just be with his family.
Yeah.
So, he wouldn't let his thing interfere with his family. So, it's hard to juggle. My kid's in Nebraska, so I know if my kid was here, I wouldn't have as much time as I have to train. Because, I wouldn't sacrifice my time with him.
Right.
But he's not. But, he's still kind of like, when I did the Bulldog, he goes, I know you can do it, Dad. So that kind of screwed me up too. Because they would have said, it's okay if you don't finish. I would have been, okay, my legs are going out. I'll quit now.
Yep.
I didn't quit, but have you ever had your legs seize up on a run? Like just stop and not want to keep moving?
That run in April, that 50-miler, it was kind of almost like that. I could barely get them in front of each other. I don't know if I was totally seizing up, but they were spaghetti enough that I felt like I was going to collapse at one point.
No, it took me 10 minutes before I could start running again before my legs came back to me. And it's like the med people were like, are you sure you don't want to quit? I'm like, oh, are you sure? Yeah. We got a nice little, something we put you in and take you. Nope, don't want to do it. But, I don't know. It felt kind of scary, but at the same time, I didn't want to quit. It's kind of like I wanted to get it done.
Right.
So what do you do for nutrition? Because my nutrition has been all over the place, and I just basically decided to go from 150 to 140 for the ultra in December. In January. So I figure if I'm lighter, I might run a little faster.
Right. My nutrition, it used to be the Stinger waffles. Nutrition was kind of hard for me because I am a diabetic, but I've had gastric bypass surgery, so it makes things a little bit interesting. But this race that I did this weekend, my nutrition was so poorly planned. I somehow I didn't bring enough, and then my drop bag was I put it in the wrong spot, and so I had a huge, 10-mile stretch where I had access to none of my nutrition. So I rely almost completely on the course nutrition. And actually, it worked out for me pretty well. I ate a lot of bananas, had access to some oranges, and a few bags of chips here and there, and I think a peanut butter jelly sandwich. It's one of those things where you always plan your nutrition so you know what your stomach can, react to. And I'm like, yeah, my stomach's got a clue what's going on now, and I'm just shoveling all this stuff in there. I had a plan. It didn't work out, so I went to plan B, and it was okay.
Yeah, I remember I got fond of oranges and watermelons on the Bulldog because, they felt good, and they didn't mess with my stomach, so I just kept eating those. I stayed away from other things. I didn't think a banana was going to work for me, so I stayed away from those.
Surprisingly, banana works for a lot of people, from my understanding, and it's not as rough as you think it is. And of course, you got the potassium in it, so that helps too.
Yeah, I'm afraid of gels too. Sometimes if you pick the wrong gel, it'll mess up your run.
Yeah, I did gels, but I didn't do goo. I always had gel cubes. And those were okay, but after you, eat a whole bunch of them, then you start getting nauseous.
Yeah, I know that one. That happened to me.
Yeah.
I had some of those cubes. Also, I do salt tablets, too. Those kind of help,
Yeah, I never got around to that. I wanted to bring salt tablets, but I didn't have any of them. So that was another thing I had to rely on, chips for.
Nice. I got a Camelback, but I won't use them for marathons. But I'll use them for the ultra. I don't know. It's a different. I've noticed when I do a marathon, I feel like it's not that big of a deal. But when I do an ultra, my mindset's completely different. It's more like, damn, am I gonna do this?
Right. And I'm right there.
It doesn't matter that it's just a couple more miles, 31 miles. But the thing is, the ultras are set in different, it's more climbing than just flat, because a marathon could be just flat and there's no obstacles.
Right, and it could be on a street, while an ultra is typically on a trail.
Yep. I like the trails. It's more calming, and I run the LA Marathon every year, but I really don't like the course. It's just...
Yeah.
Is there certain marathons that you really like, or are you more into ultras now?
I don't know. It's a different bug that bites you, and so it's got its uniqueness to it. If I had to choose a favorite type of race, I'm more of a half marathon runner because I can do a half marathon fast. But when it comes to marathons and ultras, it's definitely a lot slower for me. The last one, it was really nice. The scenery was nice. It was in a marshy area. There are alligators on the course. So that made things unique. When the sun went down, it got dark, and we all had our headlamps out, and that was a different look and feel, so it was kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, that's something I didn't have. I read the things for the no-name, the one I'm doing, the ultra. It said bring a headlamp. I didn't realize I needed one. I had to buy a new one because I lost my old one.
Yeah.
You can't really follow somebody if you can't see them.
No, you can't. And the second thing is there were quite a few on our course that didn't have them either.
I know. Everything's necessary. If you need it, you got to get it. I got to get the Camelback and just to have the liquid. So I don't, so I can refill it, and then I don't have to stop. I can just drink whenever I need to drink. instead of, you know, having to find a station. But, I mean, so you prefer half marathons?
I think I do. I think it's just, it's short enough to, you know, get in and get fast, but long enough to actually make it worth my while.
No, I did the Malibu half marathon. That was fun. I mean, because it's by the ocean, and I enjoyed it. And I did it in about an hour and 45 minutes, which
That's
I felt
cool.
good about.
I'm originally from California, so I know how the scenery in Malibu is.
I used to I go to Gold's Venice to train sometimes, so whenever I ever go to Gold's Venice, I run the beach.
Oh, there you go.
You know, just because it's there. I mean, the thing is, it's kind of funny because I would love to live in Venice, but the thing is, it'll take me away from my, you know, from my, because you know where the Hollywood sign is, right? Because you're from California.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There's Runyon Canyon, and then there's the trail up to the Hollywood sign. Those are all hill trails I can use to train. But if I live in Venice, then I lose that. You know, I'd have to, you know, spend time getting back and forth. And I like having the option to be able to, you know, run up to the observatory or run some hills. Because I notice people like at Malibu Half Marathon that were bitching about a little hill. I go, this isn't a hill. This is just a slant.
Right.
People don't know what a hill is yet. You know, it's like, you know, I tried, right now I'm trying to train like, you know, Runyon Canyon, I'm trying to run up the climb and run up this hill. Like, at least I did it twice today. I'm going to try to push it to three tomorrow and just keep building the endurance so I'm ready for the, you know, the ultra. So my, you know, so my body will go, this is easy. But my head's going, what are you thinking? You know?
Right. Yeah. And that was my problem for the April ultra that, so where I'm at in Texas, it's flat. I mean, there's like no hills here or very little ones. And so this ultra that was up in Illinois was just intense. I was a 6,000 foot elevation gain, and I thought I could do with it with what little hill work I had, but yeah, there was no way that was happening.
Yeah, next year I'm going to do the Big Bear Marathon, and there's elevation in that one. So
yeah.
I'm just going to keep running hills and getting used to like more elevation and just, you know, get my body ready for it. I mean, I like doing I don't know how Griffith Park's doing it, but they're going to have a 50K in the Griffith Park, and I don't know how they're going to manage to get 31 miles out of it.
Yeah.
I don't see how many places it can run.
Yeah. So one thing that I did for this past ultra was I actually roughed it. I bought a larger camel pack, and I actually stuck some barbells in it and some ankle weights inside of it and added about 15 pounds to my weight. And I would run 20-something miles with that thing.
Oh, beforehand, right?
Yeah, beforehand, yeah. Not during the race. It was just for the training, just to train for it. That way I knew that if I could run with a much heavier weight on my back, I stripped it all off, it'd be a whole lot easier.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I thought about doing that, but it's like, you know, yeah, I mean, when I used to run from work, I have about 10, 20 pounds of stuff in my backpack, so, yeah, I mean, it definitely you feel it when you're running.
Yep.
But no, that's an interesting idea, you know, maybe, like, if I get used to the hills, like, you know, put something in the, you know, and a heavier camel pack and more, you know, more weight, you know. It does feel lighter, you know. I mean, I've been training my legs with the weights just, and I noticed, I mean, a long time ago somebody said, if you're going to run, don't work your legs with the weights. But then I found out that it does work, so I've been strengthening my legs and it's been helping.
Mm-hmm.
But for the longest time, I was under the misconception that training your legs with weights was a bad idea. But, you know, you learn.
Yep.
So what races do you have coming up?
I'm actually off. That 50-miler was kind of the grand finale, for at least for a little while.
So you're going to take a break?
I'll probably take a break probably for the rest of the season. Unless something comes up, there might be a 10K I might do in April. But, yeah, no, I'm not looking at anything particular at the moment. My wife and I have talked about doing, and we're not even sure we're going to do it, but it would be great if we did. There's a marathon in Poland that she wants to go do, and there's a marathon in Berlin I want to go do. So, and they're within a week of each other. So
wow.
Maybe a vacation, maybe not. Yeah, it's a wish list kind of thing.
Yeah, one of my friends I met from the show is doing the first Rome marathon this year. They were going to do an LA marathon, but it falls on the same day, so they're doing the first Rome one. I actually want to do the Costa Rica marathon just because my dad's from Costa Rica.
Oh, okay.
I want to do that eventually. I got a list of ones I want to do that, you know, to me seem interesting. You know,
right.
They got one in, they got a bunch of things that, you know, that courses that you just want to do because they just seem interesting. It's kind of, I try to look for a course that's going to be interesting as I run so I don't get bored, you know, because it's like,
right.
I've run a marathon, but it's been, you know, back and forth, and I hated that because it's just like, it got boring.
Yeah,
you know,
the ones that are small loops are kind of boring.
Oh, did you see that? I think I saw somewhere on YouTube there's a run that you do inside a bunker in a circle going around and around till you finish, till the last person finishes. And it just looks kind of like, oh my, it looks painful. I mean, it just looks painful because there's nothing, there's no scenery. It's just going around, looping around. And they do it every year, and people do it when they like doing it, and I don't get that because that would make me crazy.
It would make me crazy, too.
Yeah,
but
it's
no... I think that's part of the challenge, though.
No, it would be a challenge just because there's, you know, you're just going in a circle. I don't understand somebody, like, running underground, and to me, it's better to be running up a hill in an ultra because at least you have scenery. You know, you have something
right.
You can look at, focus on. You know,
right.
And I don't know. What's been your favorite marathon so far? Ultra or whatever?
Probably my most favorite marathons are the Rock and Roll Series marathons were pretty nice when they do it in San Antonio. They were pretty good. I like the Houston Marathon. There's definitely a large crowd base, a supportive crowd base there. So I like that a lot. I would like to do the Boston Marathon, but I don't know. It's a bucket list item.
Yeah, it's a bucket list for me, too. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to – I mean, I'm trying to get to a qualifying time, but it's kind of like my best time for a marathon lately has been 4:09.
Yeah, you got
to
be 4:16, so I'm not a sub-4. I've been wanting to, and I've trained and actually completed a sub-4 unofficially, but officially not.
Well, no, all that matters is they see those numbers when you finish, and it's like – I'm trying to get to 340 again, but it's kind of like I don't want to kill myself to get there. It's like when I train, I don't kill myself to get a PR, but when I – how do you feel about 5Ks? Because I like doing those for the speed to see how fast I can go.
And except for this last year, I did train a lot for speed, and my 5K times aren't horrible. They're not outstanding, but I've been on the podium a couple of times with them. So I do like doing them.
Yeah, I actually got I try to do five. I'm not right now. I'm not doing it, but someone told me to do 10 miles and 5 miles and 10 and 5. So for the 5 miles, I was doing a speed run. I actually got my 5 miles done in 33 minutes. And I was really happy with that.
Yeah, that's impressive.
But, you know, it's kind of like, that happened once, and I went back up to, like, 37 and 38, you know. It's like, I'm happy I got there, but, you know, it's kind of like, the funny thing is when I ran a faster time doing the 5K on my own, 18 minutes, but then when I did the turkey trot, I got it in 22 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know. Sometimes what you do on your own turns out to be better than what you do when you're, you know, actually in a race.
Yeah, that's how one of my marathon training times was. I end up doing a 27 mile sub 4 and then a month later was my actual race, and I ended up doing the 4:16.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how that happens. Cause
I
have a friend of mine, Jacqueline. She's training right now, and I keep telling her, you know, the mindset when you're just training is different from when you actually do a race. I think your mind changes when you're actually, you know, got all these people around and you're trying to see how fast you can go.
I think it's the adrenaline that kicks in.
Yeah, and I've been telling, I mean, she's been doing great. I mean, I'm impressed because, I mean, you know, by, you know, how she's training, because it's she's getting back to it, and she also has, you know, medical things but that she's working through, and it's, I'm impressed that she keeps going, you know, and it's like, you know, and I just think somebody like that should just be encouraged, and, you know, and I admire
right.
somebody who can actually have medical issues and keep going.
Right.
You know, and it's, you know, but it, a lot of people, you know, it's like, I just think most runners are super masochists, you know? No, because, I mean, the second time I did the hill today, I'm like, going, why the fuck am I doing it twice? Once was good enough, but tomorrow I'm probably going to try for three.
Yep.
You know, just
totally get it.
Just so I'm like, but I just don't know. It's some kind of, when I first start, it's kind of funny. I don't know if it works for you, but when I first start to run, I'm not there yet, but 5-6 miles, it kicks in, and then I'm just going.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a lot for me, too.
Because, I mean, sometimes when you start, I mean, sometimes when you, I, when you start a run, you don't even feel like doing it, and then once you get into it, it kicks in, and you're great. But the whole thing is, if you don't do it, it doesn't get a chance to kick in. So I try to even run when I don't feel like it.
Mm-hmm.
I figured if you have too many moments when you don't feel like it, you might just stop doing it. And that actually scares me more than anything. It's just like losing what it took me so long to gain, you know?
Right.
So you have Boston on your bucket list. Are there any other runs you have on your bucket list?
No, I think not really. Other than maybe the European stuff, but nothing's flagged out there.
Yeah, actually, I want to run. I mean, I don't know. This would probably be a horrible marathon because it's all flat in Nebraska. I'd want to do it just so my son could see me run because he lives in Nebraska.
Right.
I mean, but I would do that just for, you know, for him to see me. But I don't know. Nothing. I've been to Nebraska. God, it was flat. Super flat. I was just like, there's no hills. Nothing. You know, it's just, mm-hmm. I mean, if you only live in Nebraska, I could see them believing that the earth is flat. Because,
right.
like, there's no hills. But, yeah. So,
look at this way. It'd be a fast race.
Oh, yeah. No, I could see that. I mean, it'd be a super fast race because, I mean, it's just straight. I mean, Malibu was kind of a flat race because there's only a little bit of uphill and then just, you know, back down. I mean, when I do different races downtown, there's some uphill that will slow you down a little bit. I mean, I don't really like running downtown L.A., but I do these things because the turkey trot, because it's Thanksgiving, and, you know, I like having a little bit of traditions in my runs, you know, little ones that you do just because, you know, sentimental or whatever. So you're going to take it easy? Like, are you laying off for, I mean, are you still running, but are you still running, or are you just taking off completely?
No, I'll end up keep running. I'll probably, you know, dial it back to like 2 days a week, you know, something mild in the middle of the week and, you know, maybe a little bit longer in the weekend just to try to keep some fitness up. Yeah, I don't know. And I'm sure there'll be a race that'll come up that I'm going to want to do, and I'll probably get back into some kind of, you know, training plan.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. For me right now, I mean, if my son was around, I probably wouldn't train as much, but since he's not, I kind of like, I wake up, go to the gym, I run, then I come home, take a nap, then go to work and repeat. You know, that's just the way my head's been working, but I don't have my kid in front of me, so I don't, you know, I know if I had him here, I would not have that much time to train.
Right.
You know, I mean, because you can't lose time with your family, I mean, no matter how much the other stuff's important to you. You know, you can't replace that.
No, you can't. You gotta do the best you can to juggle.
Even though you like hearing your son bragging, your son was bragging at school, yeah, my dad could outrun your dad.
I don't think any of my kids have said that.
My son, actually, his mother told me, yeah, he was bragging about how much you run. I'm like, damn, that's nice. You know, and one time he called me up on his phone going, yeah, guess what I'm doing? He goes, I'm running. I'm like, Max, so you get really good at it. I don't think running and talking on the phone's a good thing for you right now. But he was excited to tell me, so I just like, cool. I don't know, I mean, well, cool. It's been fun talking to you. I mean, I'd love to have you back on if you go to Poland, and then we can talk about that, you know, or your progress or your next projects. I mean, I try to bring people back when, they, you know, if they've done another race. I've already brought back two people who've done different races, you know, just to see where they are, where they've gone, and how much they progress or, like, what they're doing.
Yeah, sure. I can do that.
And thanks for being on the show, and I'll send you the link in a few, and then, of course, I'm going to post it I'm actually going to post it. This is funny. I posted on poetry websites, and then I posted on marathon websites, and both groups actually listen to both shows, I mean, both parts. So it's kind of interesting to me that, you know, because poets are not really, I don't want to knock them because I write poetry too, but they're not really that into being in shape. Kind of, you know, it's a different world to them. It's like, you know, poetry is a different world of runners, and that's what I mean. I like the mix because those are two things that I'm, you know, that I dig. So I like bringing the two things together. So it gets two different audiences, you know, finding out about, you know, different ways to live.
Right.
But yeah, thanks for being on the show. We just had Bart Strauss on the show. Ultra runner, run more miles than I have. God knows I want to get to where you are. But thanks for being on the show, and this has been another episode of Poet Runner, and please come back tomorrow because we have another show. And thanks a lot, Bart, for being on the show.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Of course.